It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out about a one-of-its-kind program at the UW-Madison focusing on hip-hop and urban arts that's going strong in its 10th year.
First, Republican presidential candidates faced off last night in the last debate of 2015. We're now a month and a half away from the Iowa caucuses, the kickoff of what's shaping up to be an uncertain primary fight.
On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton is maintaining her lead over Bernie Sanders in both Iowa and national polls. And also this week, the House and Senate will decide the fate of big spending and tax bills that would keep the government operating into next fall.
Time now for our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, quick read, do we have a winner coming out of last night's GOP debate?
I guess CNN's a winner for all the people that tuned in. But no, I don't think that there was a real quote-unquote winner. I think this might have actually been the most even-handed debate, where pretty much all of the top candidates did fairly well, or at least didn't do disastrously bad. Donald Trump held his own. He really didn't get attacked. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz kind of both elevated each other. And Jeb Bush, who had been pretty much left for dead, and I think most people don't believe that he is going to end up being the nominee, he got in a few good verbal barbs with Donald Trump. So I think everyone kind of did well, and I don't expect much necessarily to change because of the debate.
In terms of substance, a lot of focus on national security last night. What were some of the main themes you saw in the back and forth?
So this is one of the most interesting sort of things that's come about this primary. A lot of people for a while have been waiting for this matchup between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, both quote-unquote Tea Party candidates, or candidates that aligned with the Tea Party, both who were recently elected to the United States Senate, Marco Rubio in 2010, Ted Cruz in 2012. And they do differ on foreign policy. Marco Rubio is one of the most hawkish candidates in the field. I mean, maybe Lindsey Graham is more hawkish than he is. Well, Ted Cruz is, some might say he's more realistic. So, for instance, Ted Cruz argued that, hey, we cannot have go and topple dictators in the Middle East and then leave a vacuum there, because sometimes dictators may not be good for the people who are living in those countries, but they're better for us than having an ISIS come into, say, Syria or Iraq and basically make our lives very, very difficult. So it was a very interesting thing where you saw Rubio running to Cruz's right on foreign policy.
Speaking of Ted Cruz, he was maybe in the hot seat because he was leading in at least one Iowa poll, actually getting out ahead of Trump in that. Were people watching him more closely maybe than in past debates?
Yeah, I think so. You know, Ted Cruz, who was, I think the poll you're alluding to is the Des Moines Register poll, which is run by Ann Selzer, which has a very illustrious history and has been very accurate. And Cruz was leading Trump in that state in that poll 31-21%, which was Cruz's largest lead so far in Iowa. I think he is getting some real spotlight. People are starting to look more carefully at his positions, both foreign policy, immigration, whether or not he has the temperament to be president of the United States. And so right now we're sort of in this position in the race where Donald Trump is leading in the national polls. Cruz probably has a slight lead in Iowa. And then sort of Rubio is this third candidate that most people are waiting to break out, but we're not quite sure if he's going to be able to do it.
Staying with polls for a moment, a headline I love from your piece on 538, quoting, "Polls suggest Trump will win between 8% and 64% of the vote." What?
This is a great thing. So, you know, we talk about these polls and meaning something right now. So the stuff that I do is I went back to 1980, basically nomination processes without an incumbent running for that given party's nomination, said, how predictive were the polls at this point? And it turns out that while the people who poll high generally do well, there are plenty of those that don't. So the margin, what I call the predictive margin of error, given that Trump is polling right now in the low 30s, he could end up well back in the single digits based solely on the polling, or he could end up well up into the 60s. And the other candidates as well who are polling lower, they could end up far ahead of where they are right now. So the polls right now may say Donald Trump's ahead, but there is a long way to go.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538 in our weekly wrap-up of national politics. I want to touch base with Chris Christie back on the main stage. He'd been bumped out in a previous debate. Some momentum you've talked about with us before in New Hampshire. He definitely was trying to make himself heard last night.
Yeah, he was definitely going to go for that vote. That was all these candidates that were on the stage. You had the Rubio and Cruz debate that was, quote-unquote, substantive, and Christie was, after they spoke, like, this is just Senate talk, people. I want to talk to you real. I want to be this real guy, sort of this macho man, almost in the Donald Trump sort of mold. And indeed, Christie and Trump sort of get the same supporters up in New Hampshire, and both these moderate liberal voters, they both get them. And Christie does have some sense of momentum. And keep in mind, the race in New Hampshire right now, even though Trump is ahead, he's not as far ahead as he is nationally. He's only in the mid-20s. And Christie is right around 10% of the vote. All he needs to do is pick up a few percentage points more support, and he will be the clear second-place person there. And say then Cruz wins in Iowa and Trump drops further in New Hampshire, Christie might be able to pick up the scraps and win a state like New Hampshire. So Christie is in the ballgame right now, but he still has a long way to go.
Stay with polls for a minute, but on the Democratic side, some new polls coming out. What are we seeing there?
It's the same old story. Look, people seem to think that maybe there's a contest on the Democratic side. I know the Bernie Sanders fans critique me often for saying that the Democratic race is all but over, and the polls right now, though, show that this race is pretty much all but over. Hillary Clinton continues to command a very large lead nationally. She's near 60%, 55 to 60% of the vote. In Iowa, she has not trailed in a poll in at least 3 months. She's up, depending on which poll you look at, from somewhere from, say, like 8 to, I think, one poll had her up nearly 32 percentage points. That's a wide margin of error, to be sure, but she's clearly ahead, and she has the endorsements from all these elected officials, and those in the past, when someone has as many endorsements as she's had, in fact, she has the most on record, but anybody who has anywhere close to the amount of endorsements she has at this point in the campaign have easily gone on the win. So she just remains prohibitive favorite on the Democratic side.
But, Harry, I saw a tweet you sent out that had the words Martin O'Malley, surge, and there was a chart.
Yes, there was a chart. I was being a little jokey.
I figured.
Martin O'Malley has gone up from all the way from 1% to 5% in Iowa. It's kind of upsetting or sad in some way. Martin O'Malley is a serious candidate. Had been governor of Maryland for 2 terms. I think he came into this race believing he was going to be the anti-Hillary Clinton, but it just hasn't worked out for him. Bernie Sanders speaks much more to the liberal base than the Democratic Party, and O'Malley is just sort of a third wheel in this race.
Let's visit Congress now, Harry. They're set to vote on tax and spending packages in the coming days. A big bill, a lot of deals, a lot of subpoints there. Can't get to everything there, but what stands out?
I think what stands out is that Congress is actually going to compromise. People are saying that Congress is broken, but, you know, the reports have been and had been for a while now that they were going to come to an agreement. They're going to do the spending bill separately from the tax bill. But it seems to me that both sides are both happy and unhappy. They didn't get everything they wanted. You know, Democrats are not particularly happy with the ending of the U.S. export ban on oil. Republicans didn't get exactly what they wanted with regards to Syrian refugees and perhaps putting a halt on that program or making it much more difficult to get into the country. But it seems that both sides have come to the table, have compromised, and we are going to have a spending and tax bill in place by the end of the year.
So there aren't enough things that either side is angry enough to where there are deal breakers that are going to get enough votes or fail to get enough votes, I guess, to shut this thing down.
Right. It doesn't seem so. So, I mean, the Democrats are probably going to provide more than half the votes for the spending bill. Republicans are much more reluctant to back that, but there'll be enough Democrats to back the spending bill while there'll be enough Republicans to back the tax break bill. So basically, neither side's exactly happy. But at this point, unless there's some, and I never put it past Washington to, you know, screw something up, but unless there's some 23rd hour thing that goes on, it looks like this bill is going to pass.
As of right now, any idea when it will pass?
They're saying potentially by the end of the week. We'll see. But at this point, that's what it's looking like.
So no debates, I think, for the rest of calendar year 2015. Back to the presidential race for a moment, Harry. What are you watching for in terms of polls or other indicators?
I think there are going to be basically three things that I'm watching for. Number one, on the Republican side, is there going to be a candidate who can get the support of what I call the party actors, basically those who are elected to Congress, the governors? Right now, the party actors really haven't gotten behind any of the candidates big time. In the past, the candidate who gets the majority of support from these party actors tends to go on and win. So we're going to see if one person is able to corral, you know, a much more sizable plurality. Two, we're going to look and see, can Rubio break out anywhere? Right now he's kind of holding back. He continues to have very high favorability ratings, but can he break out in either Iowa or New Hampshire? And three, Chris Christie in New Hampshire, can he break out from, say, 10% to 15 or 20%? And if he can, then that race could get very interesting very quickly in New Hampshire.
Harry, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics.
UW-Madison's First Way program is blazing a new path for students with a first-of-its-kind program in the country. The First Way program started 10 years ago when William Ney, director of the Office for Multicultural Arts Initiative, was troubled by the lack of diversity among students at UW-Madison.
So funding for First Wave provided scholarships and drew students interested in arts, academics, and activism. Today it's going strong, and it's the only program of its kind in the country.
William Ney joins us now in studio. He's the founding executive director of the Office of Multicultural Arts Initiatives at UW-Madison, which houses the First Wave Hip Hop and Urban Arts Scholarship Program. And also joining us, Deshaun McKinney. He's a third-year student at UW-Madison studying English creative writing, and he's a poet, a rapper, an actor, activist, and scholar. Deshaun, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And William, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having us.
So, Willie, we're going to start with you. Tell us a little bit about how the First Wave program first got started.
Well, it had a lot to do with the connection I had with a leader named James Cass, who was the founder of Youth Speaks, which is probably the premier spoken word organization in the country. He's out of the Bay Area, and he graduated from the UW-Madison. And he had heard about some of the work that we were doing in the Madison School District with poetry slams and activities with youth. And he actually said, why don't you get a group of students to go to the Brave New Voices, which is their national poetry competition, and you can experience what it's like to have, you know, hundreds of youth in one space doing poetry. And so actually I went out there. I found out I was the only university person amongst a bunch of chaperone and teachers and obviously young artists. And this whole spoken word movement was very new to me. And what the Poetry Slam movement didn't have is a kind of a vehicle to higher education. They empowered youth. They did poetry, you know, slams, writing. But the students, when they turned 19, they didn't really have an outlet to where to go to. And so, you know, I was here at the UW-Madison at that time in Latin American Studies. And so I said this would be a great base foundation for, you know, young folks to end up at the university through this movement. And so I proposed the idea to Daryl Bissell, who's the chief financial officer, basically, or vice chancellor of administration, and said, kind of whoever creates a framework and a support for these students from across the country who are great young poets and artists, you know, would be, you know, a great gold mine for a university. And so that's how it kind of really began.
And Deshaun, you're in your third year in the First Wave program. What does First Wave give you that you might not be able to do if you'd gone to a different university?
So many things. I think the very unique appeal of First Wave is what draws a lot of First Wave students to university first. I think a lot of students would choose to go elsewhere if it weren't for the things that First Wave provides. And what that is, in many senses, is like artistic development and artistic opportunities. And it gives you a vehicle to maintain your art while also pursuing other knowledge interests. So like you don't have to major in anything arts related if you're a First Wave scholar, right? We have people studying like the sciences and astrology and things like that, but they're also poets and they're also like rappers and things like that. So First Wave allows you to pursue both things and to find like your place. And it also gives you very unique access to people in these artistic fields. Like we've have unique internships with things like Hot 97 and New York, which is like the premier hip hop radio station, and they also have these people come in, major producers and artists and so on and so forth. So like it's this unique access and development, and also that dual nature that it allows you is all really important.
And along with being part of the First Wave program, you're also part of the Young, Gifted, and Black activist group here on campus. And I've read that First Wave has a focus also on activism. So Deshaun, I want to ask you about that. What does First Wave do to support the work that you do as an activist?
Well, I'm actually not a part of Young, Gifted, and Black. I've worked a lot with them, though.
You organized something.
Yeah, I've organized many things on campus. And when it oftentimes, when working in the community, they're the premier group to go to. They're the ones doing the groundwork in the community. But I'm involved in a lot of other organizations on campus. I'm also a part of the board of directors for the United States Student Association, and I do a lot of grassroots work on campus. And again, that being one of First Wave pillars, I think a lot of what they do is make these connections. They allow students pathways to pursue their different activist focus, and they also let students know that activism looks different for different students, right? So there's students who want to go work in the Madison high schools with the youth and things like tutoring and bringing them to campus, letting them know that higher education is a possibility. There's things more like protesting and marching. There's teach-ins. So there's all these different avenues, and I think First Wave has the proper foresight and connections to allow students access to these different spaces so they can pursue their own personal kind of commitment to activism.
And Willie, let's ask you about that too. So there are three pillars I've read mm-hmm. to this program that are mm-hmm. important: arts, academics, and activism. Tell us a little bit. We've heard a little bit about the arts there from Deshaun. Tell us a little bit about the academics and especially the activism.
Well, academics is obviously the most important pillar for us. You know, they're scholar artists before they're artist scholars. First of all, they're not going to be able to get into UW-Madison, a top-tier, world-class university, without having excellent grades, you know, really strong academic trajectory. And so, so that's the beauty of it. You know, you're getting a cohort of, like, amazingly high-level scholars who are also artists, you know, and at the same time that, you know, we do not allow a student into our program that hasn't, you know, demonstrated a strong commitment to community activism, social justice issues. So you do have this full package. This is a very holistic approach towards recruiting these young leaders of America. And now we have our first Chinese students, so I'd say global citizens. The main thing is we provide also wraparound support services academically when students come. So we have, you know, tutoring programs. We have extremely strong advising through IDEA. Sefa, who's our amazing academic advisor and assistant director. And so it's one of those things that we have a very, very strong track record. And we're at now about a 90%+ graduation rate. And our students are going on to the top MFA and doctoral programs in the country. This particular fall, three of our students got fully funded graduate program scholarships to the UW-Madison, one in psychology, one in the creative writing program, and one in anthropology. So now they're graduating and they're giving back into the community from where they came from, which is First Wave.
Now, this is a big university. A lot of students go here. Deshaun, does this give you a sense of community that you might not have had if you weren't part of First Wave?
Yeah, I think that's one of the more important facets of First Wave for a lot of students, right? So the demographics in this university are 43,000 plus students. And the majority of those being white, right? And in First Wave is a program that also services underrepresented students, so the majority of students in the program are also students of color. But if you break those demographics down at the university, they're dismal. So, like, students have a hard time finding community on campus. So First Wave definitely offers that to people, because I remember my first year coming onto campus, as soon as there's something called the Summer Collegiate Experience, which is 8-week Bridge to College program that all First Waivers, among other scholarship programs, have to go through and kind of help you transition into college. And I remember stepping onto campus during that summer, and other First Waivers in the program, as soon as they found out about us, even without knowing us, they already offered, like, hey, you come all to my house so I can make you dinner and we can get to know each other and things like that. And how important that is to help a student understand that there's space for you here, there's community for you here, there's safety for you here. All those things First Wave with its community offers.
Now, I remember this was several years ago. I ended up by chance at a First Wave event where there was a lot of spoken word artistry going on, mm-hmm. and it blew me away. I had never heard of First Wave before. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the kinds of art that the students are engaged with. Willie, we'll start with you.
I mean, it's really beyond hip-hop arts. I mean, it's, you know, just broader multicultural arts. So we have students, you know, they formed their own bands. One of our students will kind of be the next Nina Simone. Her name is Taylor Scott, and she's actually now in London. She started a group called the Bellhops. Mariah Burden is, like, you know, she's a hip-hop blues singer, just amazing. And we have other groups that have formed, you know, both musical groups and dancers. It's the whole gamut, you know, and obviously within addition to the students who are just focused on their hip-hop arts and skills.
And Deshaun, as you're a third year, you've got one more year left, but what are you working on and what do you want to do with this as First Wave sends you out into the world?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure. I think my hands are in a lot of different things right now. Like, I think I'm definitely taking advantage of all three pillars. I think the main focus for me right now, I'll figure out what happens post-graduation, but I'm really just focused on traveling right now and the opportunities to take advantage of those opportunities and just get more experience and knowledge of the world. I've been fortunate to do a few study abroads and doing another one next semester. So things like that. I'll be going to Tokyo next semester.
Nice.
So that's just really important to me, given my background. Just, you know, a poor kid from Milwaukee. It's not often that you even believe the world is possible. But then coming here and being in a program like First Wave and being surrounded by so many amazing people, you start to dream a little bigger and you start to capture those opportunities. So that's kind of what I'm focused on right now.
That's a great place to leave it. Deshaun, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Willie, thank you to you as well.
Okay, thanks so much.
We've been speaking there with Deshaun Kinney, third-year student at UW-Madison, studying English and creative writing. He's a poet, he's a rapper, an actor, activist, and scholar. And Willie May was with us as well, founding executive director of the Office of Multicultural Arts Initiatives at UW-Madison, which houses the First Wave Hip-Hop and Urban Arts Scholarship Program.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, Wisconsin could hardly be further north and still be within the continental United States, but some analysts say the state is becoming more southern, at least in a cultural and a political sense.
Stephen Schuster, digital producer and editor at WBAY-TV, recently looked into the idea in a piece titled How Wisconsin Has Become More Southern. The topic has been brought up on Reddit with one user calling the state Wississippi.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think the state is becoming more culturally or politically southern? And what does that mean? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And here with us to talk about the question is Stephen Schuster. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Stephen, what kinds of changes are you talking about when you say some people are making the case that Wisconsin is becoming more southern?
Well, you know, the people that we interviewed, mainly at the University of Wisconsin, a professor said that Wisconsin has seen a shift over the last several years, culturally and politically. And a lot of that, I think, stems from a more laissez-faire reliance with the federal government and rejecting federal money and rejecting federal rules and regulations when it comes to the environment or transportation or health care.
And you've got a quote in your piece, political scientist David Cannon says, quote, Wisconsin is closer to Alabama and Mississippi than Minnesota and Massachusetts. Tell us more about the kind of evidence that David Cannon gave.
Well, you know, I think as far as the environmental regulations, that's a very strong tie to the South. If you look at the recent lawsuit where Wisconsin is now suing the EPA over carbon emissions, you know, Wisconsin has joined several other states, and if you look at those states, they're Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Missouri, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, Wyoming. A lot of these are southern states, and some of the other ones are more in the old Rust Belt, and that seems to be more politically in line with Wisconsin.
And when we're talking about arenas outside of politics, like culture, for instance, what are you seeing there?
Well, you know, in the Green Bay area, one of my colleagues here at WBAY recently did a story about a proposed 45,000 square foot facility on a 37-acre development in Bellevue, which is outside of Green Bay, which would feature upscale retail stores, single family homes, and a gun club in the form of a Southern-style mansion. Hunting has always been a strong part of Wisconsin's culture, and I think that this type of gun club kind of expands on that and is more of in line with something you'd see in the South with this type of mansion. So as far as guns and hunting and the environment, I think it extends into many arenas.
Well, as you say, hunting has always been a strong strand running through Wisconsin culture. What is it a little bit more that you think about this particular development that takes it to the next level?
Well, this proposed development in Green Bay is this gun club in the form of a Southern-style mansion would be the first of its kind in Wisconsin, if not in the North. And it would, you know, hopefully draw in crowds from all over the country. And this type of development is not something that Wisconsin has seen before. It's been more of an outdoor type of activity. And the gun clubs that are here are nothing on the scale of a Southern-style mansion.
You also wrote about country music suddenly getting a lot more played, drawing bigger artists to Wisconsin. Where have you seen that?
Well, you know, the rec center up here, Summerfest in Milwaukee, has gotten a lot of top talent. I think it's a statewide increase in lacrosse. I think Randy Houser was just there. You know, I think that part of it is that mainstream is music has, or country has become more mainstream, but also I think that, you know, there's been definitely an increase in demand with all the country music festivals in the area, in northern Wisconsin and Oshkosh, and in other parts of the state. It seems like there's definitely an increased demand, and even some local artists here in Wisconsin that have are trying to make a name for themselves in Nashville and Austin.
And we are talking right now with Stephen Schuster, who is a digital producer and editor at WBAY, talking about his piece considering the question of whether or not Wisconsin is becoming more politically and culturally Southern. We started with some of the politics there, talking about that, looking at things like right-to-work laws, gun laws, Act 10, rejecting Medicaid expansion, things like that, that Professor David Cannon has says are more in line with Southern politics. And now we're talking about some of the different aspects here. What about food? You also talk about food.
Well, you know, I mean, I think Cracker Barrel, for example, is a chain that has based in Tennessee that is all over the South. It's practically at every exit in Tennessee in major areas. And, you know, you're seeing an expansion here in Wisconsin. They have locations, I think, one in Madison, one in Kenosha, one in Germantown, one in the Dells. It wouldn't surprise me if northeastern Wisconsin saw that. There's also local restaurants here that serve the same type of catfish and collard greens and grits that you'd find in, you know, the middle of Mississippi.
So some changes in cuisine there, too. Is that happening everywhere, though, where people get more interested in regional cuisines? And maybe it's not just Wisconsin.
Well, you know, I think it depends on where you are. I lived in the Baltimore area for a while, and that certainly, the Port of Baltimore had a rich tie to the South, and there was a lot of Southern food there, and I think it's definitely, you know, not a stranger to northern states either, but I think there has been definitely an expansion in this area. I don't yet see Waffle House here, but definitely Cracker Barrel has expanded.
You know, in some ways the differences that you're talking about a bit are the divides between the urban and the rural, and not just the North and the South. And northern Wisconsin has always had, in some places, a rural culture going, or at least partially a rural culture, more than southern Wisconsin. So, but is the change beyond that?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question.
Well, you're talking about north and south culturally, and could you also phrase that another way? Could you also say, instead of northern and southern culture, could you say urban and rural culture instead?
I mean, I think you could on one hand, but if you look at places like Georgia, you know, outside of Atlanta, it's very rural. But in Atlanta, you know, it's some of the same Southern values, and you see the same type of bow tie wearing type of clothing and style, and you'll see people holding doors for people. And I think you see that in the Midwest more than you would in the Northeast.
We're talking right now with Stephen Schuster, digital producer and editor at WBAY, and we're talking about whether or not Wisconsin is becoming more politically and maybe more culturally Southern.
It's a provocative idea, and we'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you see things to back this up, this idea that Wisconsin is becoming more Southern politically, culturally, or do you not see that? Is Wisconsin becoming more Southern? What would that mean? What are some examples you might share? And if you moved here to Wisconsin from the South, we would especially like to hear from you. Compare and contrast what life is like here in Wisconsin versus life in a Southern state. And we are talking wide-ranging politics, culture, lifestyle. All of it is up for grabs here. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now with Stephen Schuster, digital producer and editor at WBAY. He recently wrote a piece called How Wisconsin Has Become More Southern.
He looked at examples of ways that people are seeing the state more like a southern state in terms of politics, but also things we associate with southern culture, making inroads here in Wisconsin as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your observations. Do you see Wisconsin being more southern, and what does that mean? In what ways? What kinds of cultural changes have there been in the state, politics and beyond? And again, if you're from the southern part of the United States originally, you're here in Wisconsin now, compare and contrast. What are things like there? What are they like here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our first caller now. We've got Jacob with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi, I just want to call and concur with what I believe is the fact that we're becoming really similar to the South, Mississippi in particular, in that our politics here in the state are becoming shamelessly corrupt. Bills are being passed right and left that show we don't have any shame about it either.
All right, Jacob, thank you for that call. And Stephen, what do you say to that? Do you think that there are parallels that political scientists see? I don't know about the corruption. I don't know about southern corruption either, but are there parallels politically to be made again?
Well, I mean, I don't want to really touch the subject of corruption at this point, but I will say that as far as just how Wisconsin is mirroring southern states and what Professor Cannon said, I certainly see how the Walker administration and the Wisconsin legislature has move forward to protect the interest of states' rights. And that certainly does have an effect on several areas as far as the environment, education. It really extends to Act 10. A lot of the legislation even that was just signed today as far as the Government Accountability Board, as far as transparency, and there's a lot of different types of legislation that certainly I think from right-to-work laws, gun laws, Medicaid expansion, public education, the environment, campaign finance, I could go on. I think there's definitely a similarity of Wisconsin trying to fight for the state's rights, which is what I think, goes back to the Civil War. And if you talk to people in the South, they'll tell you that, the war was not about slavery. It was about states' rights. And I think that the South and other states like Wisconsin are really, trying to advocate for less government intervention from the federal government.
Thank you for your call, Jacob. We appreciate that. And we're going to go on now to Ben in Madison. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Y'all doing all right there? listen, my comment is this. I believe that having lived in Atlanta, Georgia for 25 years, just the black culture, the African-American culture is just not here in Wisconsin. And I do think that that is a major contributor to the southern culture. And we just don't have that here in Wisconsin. So I'll hang up at this point and let you talk about that.
All right, Ben, thanks for the call. And Stephen, what about that? You didn't get into race in your piece, but do you have any thoughts now as we talk about this?
Well, I think that Milwaukee, statistically has a much higher unemployment rate among African Americans. I heard at one point it was above 50% for African American males. You'd have to fact check that. But I do think that there's definitely some, issues with segregation. I think Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country. Having lived in Baltimore and Milwaukee, I can kind of compare the two cities, and I see a lot of similarities, though, with crime trends. And I believe that one of my former colleagues at the Baltimore Sun Media Group, Justin George, is now working in Milwaukee on a project with Marquette University studying the crime trends. And I think that there's definitely some similarities to the South, but some unique pieces to the North and the Midwest as well.
All right, well, thank you for that call. And next, we're going to go to Chad. Chad is with us from Platteville. Hi, Chad.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to say that I kind of disagree. I think that Wisconsin's culture and political views are pretty deeply rooted, past the Civil War time frame to now, specifically in Southwest Wisconsin. I just really don't think that it's
maybe too soon to say this.
Right, absolutely. I think that I've been in the military for about 20 years, served with a couple units in Mississippi, and it's really different. I don't think that, I think globalization is happening, so that's the reason why we're getting Cracker Barrels, Walmart everywhere. So that has some bearings on things, but I don't think that we're losing who Wisconsin is.
Really interesting, Chad. Thank you for your perspective there. And Chad is saying it's maybe too soon to be talking like this, that Wisconsin's culture is pretty deep and has a long history, that it can't sort of change in the space of, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, that this is something that's maybe looking at other factors that are causing the shift that you're talking about, Stephen. What do you think about that?
I think that's certainly a valid point. I think that it might maybe too soon to tell how the new legislation that has been passed over the past 5 or 10 years will shape Wisconsin in the future. I think it is too early to tell a lot of that. But at the same time, I do think that a lot of the legislation that has been passed has been in the interest of states' rights, and that's something that has been a Southern tradition since the Civil War.
We're talking with Stephen Schuster right now, digital producer and editor at WBAY, the ABC affiliate in Green Bay, talking about his recent piece considering the question about whether Wisconsin is becoming more Southern. And he looks at things like politics, at legislation passed, at culture, at food. And we haven't talked about this yet, but even a little bit the weather. And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we're going to go next to Bill in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hi, I just want to say that as a veteran who has lived around the country, that I work in Madison and live in rural Wisconsin, so I think that it's a polarization more than becoming more Southern. The Madison area is becoming much like Northeast, liberal, very condescending, and a little holier-than-thou type attitude. And the rural portions of Wisconsin, where I live, are very much rooted in the small government, I'm doing my thing, I'm not hurting you, leave me the heck alone type attitude.
All right, Bill, thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate that. And Bill saying, yeah, it's more urban-rural as he sees it. What do you say, Stephen?
Well, I definitely can see that point as well. Having grown up in southeastern Wisconsin, lived on the East Coast, and now moved back to Wisconsin, I can certainly see how there's definitely, the extremes on the left and the right have gotten to be, I think, more visible. I think that, if you go back to the Civil War again, you look at border states like Kentucky or Missouri or even Maryland, where you had brothers fighting against brothers and one person on one side and one versus the other. I think that there's definitely an extreme on both sides, and you can see the polarization and the divide, and it's certainly, I think, probably torn apart some relationships professionally and personally. I think that I've seen a lot of consequences from the polarization, and it's really, I think the state has really changed from what it was 10 years ago.
Thanks a lot for the call. And next we're going to go to Dave. Dave is with us from Madison. Dave, hi.
Yes, hello. I can't generalize, but I'd say yes and no in terms of the similarity. Yes, in the fact that our wages now in Wisconsin are below both Georgia and Louisiana, and last year I think we flip-flopped with Alabama. So that trend certainly is consistent with what people are earning in many parts of the South. On the other hand, and I work for companies in North Carolina and elsewhere, they certainly are more aggressive in generating jobs than we are here in Wisconsin. We're still crying in our beer regarding that loss of the GM job in Janesville, and there's been over 20 transplant automobile plants built mainly in the South and border states, also Ohio in the last 30 years. So in that way, we're different than the South, I think. I think they also see
higher education as being a source of jobs and strength in at least North Carolina, in Alabama, I'm going to say maybe South Carolina, certainly Texas. And here in Wisconsin, of course, we're assuming that that won't be the key job creator. So, yes, in some ways more similar, in some ways not so similar.
All right, Dave, thanks for that. And Dave saying that in his experience, some of the southern states that he's spent some time in are more aggressive at generating jobs and look at higher education a little bit differently, some things you didn't get into in your piece. But what's your response to that?
Well, I think, you know, the South has different values, and I'm seeing some of those, you know, cultural views in the South kind of, I think, spill over into Wisconsin. I think that, you know, jobs in the economy have been an issue across the country. I don't think anybody was really immune from that, Wisconsin being no exception. I think, you know, GM saw hits in Detroit, and in Michigan saw a lot of job loss. So I don't think we can just single out Wisconsin and say that, you know, this was all in Wisconsin. But I do think that, you know, lower taxes and less services has been a typical southern value, and I see that trend sort of trying to expand into Wisconsin, but also you know, trying to do more with less, and rather than raise taxes, try to manage money better, I think has been the goal of this administration. And you know, whether that's happened, I think time will tell.
And we're going to leave it there. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Stephen Schuster, digital producer and editor at WBAY, the ABC affiliate in Green Bay. And if you want to chime in on this one, there is a lively thread going over on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you've spent any time in Madison, maybe even just on a drive into a football or basketball game, a many-tentacled icon of the capital city is going away.
We're talking, of course, about the giant swirling octopi that rotate in front of the handful of octopus car washes around the city. They're light green, if memory serves me correct, and each octopus is holding a car washing implement.
The chain got sold. The new owners are uninstalling the handy octopi. As we speak, the question, what next for the octopus family?
We could put one in our office.
They're kind of big. I don't think maybe the lobby,
the lobby
or something like that. But it's on social media. We keep seeing pictures. Oh, I saw, hey, there was an octopus on the truck driving through our neighborhood. But these are icons.
They are. I have a lot of memories about the octopi.
You said you live near one.
I had one right out my apartment window when I got especially bored and needed to veg out. You could watch them rotating serenely right out my front window. It was fantastic.
And this is already on some archive of lost Madison landscape things, landmarks. It's already on there. It just happened, you know, happening now, and it's already there.
That's how sad it is. Well, we're going to miss them, and we're going to go out inspired a little bit here by Ringo Starr. Here's to you, Rotating Octopi.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we